far from being an equalizer, school is the great discriminator.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
My name is Aaron Falbel. I currently live in Sunderland, Massachusetts, in the United States. In terms of my work, I am an organic farmer, and I also work part-time in a public library near where I live. I have had the great privilege of having known both the late John Holt, who many people might have read his books as an educational critic and social critic, as well as the late Ivan Illich, who was a friend of Holt's and one of the few people, I think, who really influenced Holt a lot in the early 70s, author of books such as Deschooling Society, Medical Nemesis, Tools for Conviviality, etc. So my thinking was definitely influenced by both of these people.
When people hear education, they immediately think it's learning. They don't see a distinction. They don't see a difference.
Well, I like to make a distinction. Of course, many people don't make a distinction. They use the words pretty much interchangeably. I think John Holt also made a distinction in his books. He wrote a book, for example, called Instead of Education. And he was once asked that question by a British reporter. He was asked, well, what do you mean? How do you define education? And Holt said, well, it's not a word I use personally. The word education is a word much used, and different people mean different things by it, but on the whole, it seems to me, this is still Holt talking here, that what most people mean by education has got some ideas built into it, or contains certain assumptions, and one of them is that learning is an activity which is separate from the rest of life, and done best of all when we are not doing anything else, and best of all in places where nothing else is done. Learning places, places especially constructed for learning. Another assumption is that education is a designed process in which some people do things to other people or get other people to do things, which will presumably be for their own good. In short, education means that some A is doing something to somebody else B. That's what education, I think, means. It's a technical process or some type of treatment that somebody does to somebody else, presumably for their own good. And that person who receives the treatment comes to believe that as well, to internalize the need for that process or that treatment and feel deprived if they don't get it or get enough of it. Learning, on the other hand, I believe is a natural process, a biological process, really, like breathing is. We do it all the time. Babies, from the moment they are born, are already learning. They're very good at learning. Their learning does not need to be developed or improved or enhanced in any way, I think. The notion that people need to be taught how to learn or need to go to school in order to learn how to learn, which are phrases we hear all the time, I think is preposterous and deeply insulting to babies who are prodigious learners. I don't usually use the word learning very much because it seems to me to make an issue out of learning is akin to make an issue out of breathing. Why do we need to make such a fuss about something which we all do naturally? John Holt, I think, said in the introduction to Teach Your Own, his book about the homeschooling movement, that learning is not a topic he discusses very much because he described it akin to breathing, that if we were in a society where everyone talked about breathing, how are you breathing today? Are you breathing better? Are you breathing well enough? We would assume that everybody were sick. And today, I think we, with all this emphasis on learning and whether we're learning as best as we can, we also assume that people are somehow impaired. They're not able to learn and they need some type of assistance or treatment or arrangements to ensure that they are learning everything they need to learn or are learning as well as they should be learning. So all this type of thinking I would like to get away from and instead talk really on activities, on doing things, on people participating in the life around them.
It hasn't always been around this whole idea of education. I'm just wondering, talk about what's wrong with it.
Well, of course, education has many functions aside from anything that has to do with learning or anything that has to do with the welfare of children. It has functions, and I suspect a lot of those functions have to do with the fixation that the authorities in Canada have, or in any country virtually. And that is, education is a means for sorting people into winners and losers, because most of us live in a society that is organized hierarchically, with very few good jobs, winner slots at the top, and many more loser positions, or bad job, menial work type of jobs at the bottom. So society needs some mechanisms, if it's shaped that way, for deciding who gets into the high places and who doesn't. And education is the way, in most industrial societies anyway, that we used to do that. Prior to that, it had to do with inheritance or lineage, but now education does the job. And of course, we know, does not do so in any way a fair manner or a meritocratic manner. In every society where such things are measured, educational achievement correlates almost perfectly with social economic status. In other words, the people who already have those scarce winner slots make sure that their children are the ones who succeed in school and who have sort of a leg up to succeed in school so that they get into the good schools and get into those good slots. And, of course, there are a few exceptions where some poor kid goes to Harvard or Yale or somewhere like that, but that's an exception. That's 1 in 1,000 or maybe 1 in 10,000 that gets to do that. So education is necessary for society to work in the way it does. In other words, to distribute privilege unequally. Education thus upholds a systematic injustice that our society needs in order to keep functioning smoothly. If everyone, you know, were to be winners, if everyone did all the work that the school says they're trying to get them to do, society would fall apart because society needs winners and losers and more losers than winners. Ivan Illich saw the educational process as so pernicious because not only did it enforce this systematic injustice, but it was a way of, I think he called it, self-inflicted discrimination, where you internalize the process to such an extent that you blame yourself for not having made it, for not being a successful student, and for not making your way into one of those winner slots, which of course only a few people can get by definition. Most teachers believe what they're in the classroom to provide equal educational opportunity to everyone. But if they look at the results of their administrations, what they do, they will see that they have to give a certain number of people A's or good grades, and other people's B's, C's down the line. If a teacher gave everyone A's, very soon the principal or supervisor would come and say, well, you can't do that. Your standards must be too low. You need to be stricter. You have to raise your standards and make sure that only a few people get the A's and the rest B's, C's, you know, along the lines of a bell curve. Again, here's this sorting mechanism at work. So it's not equal educational opportunity. It's a way of creating a system of 16 or 22 or however many levels there are of dropouts. Each successive layer of dropouts informs people where they are, where they're situated, what their social status is in society.
I'm out here 1,000 miles from my home, walking a road other men have gone down. I'm seeing your world of people and things. Here, paupers and peasants and princes and kings. Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song about a funny old world that's a-coming along. Seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn. It looks like it's a-dying and it's hardly been born. Hey, Woody Guthrie, but I know that you know.
all the things that I'm a-saying and many times more. I'm a-singing you this song, but I can't sing enough, 'cause there's not many men who've done the things that you've done. Here's to Cisco and Sonny and Leadbelly too, and to all the good people that traveled with you. Here's to the hearts and the hands of the men that come with the dust and are gone with the wind. I'm leaving tomorrow, but I could leave today. Somewhere down the road someday, the very last thing that I'd want to do is to say I've been hitting some hard traveling too.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
Far from being an equalizer, school is the great discriminator, the great sorting mechanism. Why do we have education, the idea of education to begin with? Why do we have to make special arrangements for learning? If learning is a biological process that happens in every human being, all human beings are learning from the moment they're born, so why do we need to make these arrangements? And I think what Illich does, he defines education as learning under the assumption of scarcity. In other words, that valuable learning is scarce in society. It's not something that happens readily, but special arrangements must be made for anything that's scarce, because if we just left things up to chance or up to the personal initiative of the learner, well, they wouldn't learn those things if they are indeed scarce. So education is an institutional arrangement wherein scarce knowledge is imparted. It's basically an institution that says to children, we don't trust you to learn. We have to make sure that you learn. We have to compel you to learn, coerce you to learn. If you don't learn, then it's your own fault. We gave you every opportunity. We gave you our best shot. It's almost second nature to believe that human beings have educational needs or learning needs, that they are born with learning needs. Ivan Illich has created a sort of a Latin phrase to describe this type of human being with this assumption. He calls it homo educandus. You know, we speak of homo sapiens as the species of, that scientists say that we are. Well, he says we're actually a subspecies called homo educandus, which means the human being born in need of education, in need of educational treatment. And this is a fundamental belief of most modern people today, that just like we have a need for food and shelter and clothing, we have a need for education, and that if we don't acquire this treatment, that we are deeply deprived and are stigmatized and are disadvantaged. Illich calls this whole enterprise into question, saying, no, we don't have educational needs, that in fact we are natively equipped with all the resources to learn. We have sense organs, we have eyes and ears and mouths and brains that are curious. I mean, anyone who has watched a 2 or 3 year old or even smaller children than that know that they hunger for learning, they hunger to be involved in everything that's going around them. They want to be a part of everything happening around them, and they are very much upset and insulted when they're not allowed to do that. This is a very powerful biological urge. I think this is the clearest evidence that we don't have educational needs. We have learning desires that are built in to the essence of our being.
If kids don't have education, they won't be successful. The whole idea of what does successful mean?
Yes, well, obviously the word successful is a concept which refers to the type of society into which that success will be achieved. I mean, our society is very much a materialistic consumer society, one that is extremely wasteful and violent, both to nature as well as to other people and other cultures. Speaking of American society now, I know that our way of life is extremely exploitative, and that we are living on the backs of people around the world. So to be a success in that type of society might be the worst thing we could wish for our children and ourselves, I should point out. This whole notion of being successful has raises a lot of red flags and question marks in my own mind. I don't have children, but if I did, I would think twice about wishing them to be successful in such a society. I would much rather to see them be failures and live what I would call a decent life. But of course, that choice would be up to them. I mean, that's another function of schooling or education, to habituate children, young people, to life in that type of society, that type of consumer society. Education teaches the lesson that the more we consume, the better we are. And that's a lesson that our society needs people to imbibe in order for them to be successful consumers, in order to be, for them to be obedient consumers, which is what our economy needs. The more consumption, the better. That's the lesson. I think those people who are starting to pay attention to the results of that ideology are pretty horrified with its effects, that we can't go on consuming at this rate for very much longer at all, and that we've already done possibly irreparable damage as a result of that behavior, consuming ever more, and also, I would add, consuming far more than is our share, at least in the overdeveloped nations. If you ask the question, what is the cause of all these wars and violence, especially in recent years, I'd say it's that. It's overconsumption. It's the injustice that constitutes the United States and other developed countries, overdeveloped countries, from consuming far more than is our share. I know in the United States we consume between 25% and 50% of world's resources, energy resources, materials, etc., whereas we comprise only 5% of the world's population. That type of injustice has to be backed up by brute force. Why else would most of the people around the world just surrender their labor and raw materials and whatever else to us? It's education that prepares people for that level of consumption. Ivan Illich talked about it as an initiation ritual for life in a consumer society. Earlier societies have had different types of initiation rituals that marked the transition from childhood to adulthood. In our society, adulthood means primarily a life of consumption, and so we inculcate this idea early on in children's experiences by having them go through this process of graded consumption, which we call education. It's a lesson which is learned, I think, to people's detriment as they grow older. We are an expert worshiping society, and we're also taught that we need to specialize in something. We need to find our line of work, whatever that is, mostly in exclusion to anything else. We need to, you know, if we go to college, we need to declare a major. Or if we don't go to college, we need to find our line of work, our trade, our profession, and that's what we will specialize in perhaps for the rest of our lives. This is something relatively new in human history. Most people did not live that way, did not have to find their work, their trade. I wrote an essay in the last issue of Growing Without Schooling magazine, a magazine started by John Holt in 1977, and that essay was called Questioning Work. In that essay, I questioned this notion, sort of like a follow-up to growing without schooling, growing without work. This might be sort of unschooling for adults, just like school is the rat race for children. Well, the world of work and employment is the rat race for adults, and maybe this is not necessary either. Earlier societies did not function this way. They were not organized in this way. There are many languages still in existence today that have no word for work the way we use it. I remember reading Jean Liedmoff's book, The Continuum Concept, where she writes about her experience among the Yaquana in South America, who she calls Stone Age Indians, who lived what we would probably dismissively call a primitive life, but a very beautiful life. And they had no word for work in their language. She would try to describe to them what she meant, and they couldn't understand it, because they made no distinction in their lives between activities which were useful and those which weren't. Work was just a part of daily life. Things that needed to be done, tasks that needed to be done, were done. There was no work for them, or they didn't make any separation between work and play and leisure, or talking and joking and laughing. All that was intermingled with each other. Most people participated in the subsistence of the household. They were farmers. They had to tend to the crops, and they created the clothes that they wear and food that they ate and built the dwellings that they lived in. These were, for the most part, the activities that people did. There were some trades. There were stone cutters, and there were shoemakers and barrel makers, etc. But not everyone did that. You know, a village needed only one or two blacksmiths, and that, for the most part, most activities that people engaged with were totally separate from anything that we would call a money economy. They led the life of subsistence, and Native Americans in our continent led that type of life for millennia before the modern era, where we saw things otherwise. That, again, as you were saying, people had to suddenly specialize and choose a profession. This is a radically new way of organizing society and organizing people's lives. When I think of growing without education, I think of such a society where it is easy to learn things, easy to find activities that are worth doing for their own sake, because they're so obviously necessary, as I said, you know, growing one's food, making one's clothes, building one's dwelling, tending to children, etc. These are the primary activities of life, which nowadays are commodities or services to be purchased. Most people don't know how to grow their own food. They think food comes from the supermarket. Housing comes from construction companies. Taking care of children is purchased by childcare or through the educational establishment. All these things are delegated to other people who supposedly have professional training, which entitles them to do things and are assumed to be doing things better than we could do so ourselves. And this is another concept that Ivan Illich has talked about. He's talked about modernity as being a war against subsistence, namely that those type of primary activities that people did for generations progressively disembedded and taken away from them and put in the hands of professionals, so that subsistence nowadays is extremely rare, if not impossible. I mean, there are communities where people still know how to do these things, and I think that's where our efforts need to be put, not into education, but to what I call rejuvenating local culture, to rediscover what Wendell Berry, another one of my favorite authors, calls the domestic arts of living well within a place. And by living well within the place, I don't mean having increased access to consumer goods. I mean actually participating in our own subsistence. And yeah, that can be small. I could start with a small garden, you know, learning to spin your own yarn, which some friends of mine know how to do. Might start with, you know, building a small addition onto your house and learning those types of skills. These are the types of things that people need to relearn how to do, I think, if we are to get away from the type of consumer society we talked about earlier, to rediscover how to live in a place, to derive sustenance from a place, to disengage from the global economy in which we find ourselves today. So, yes, I wouldn't try to urge people to take a place within that global economy. I would try to go in the opposite direction. I would try to find ways in which local culture still, where there are still remnants of that local culture, and try to nourish those remnants so that they might be able to grow.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
I have a very conventional schooling myself, but I choose not to take advantage of it. Whatever resume I've used to obtain any of the jobs that I have, I've not put any educational credentials, because I don't want prospective employers or other people to judge me on the basis of the whatever schooling I've had, in a sense force them to look at me as a person, my real skills, not the amount of sitting I've done in classrooms, and not discriminate thereby against the unschooled people who don't have that experience. So this is one way to devalue these credentials that everyone feels today are necessary. And one tiny demonstration that they're not necessary, because I haven't made use of them. I've been hired to do all sorts of things, you know, without those credentials being known by my employers. I think we have to ask the question, well, what activities do we want to do in society? Not what should people learn, but what should we do? How do we live well in this place? And then open up those activities to people of all ages, not just children, but senior citizens as well. There's another excluded group in society that we tend to shunt off into old age homes or nursing homes for their own good. And I think we do a great disservice by doing that. So I'm all in favor of re-embedding people, tasks, into the life of society that's going on around them. And that, of course, means that we have to ask the question, well, how do we want to live? How do we want to live in this place? Is the way that we're living now any good? And if not, how do we change our way of life, our mode of living, our level of consumption, patterns of consumption, for example? It's one thing at a time. There's no one switch that we can pull to fix all of that. I think of that book by Helena Norberg Hodge called Ancient Futures, and she describes these people in Ladakh, in the area in north of India and adjacent to Tibet, high up in the mountains, that until relatively recently was untouched by Western civilization, by modern society, because it was inaccessible. It was high up in the Himalayas or somewhere like that. And Helena Norberg Hodge is a Swedish woman who was there mostly doing linguistic research, but she happened to be there exactly at the time when technology evolved to the extent that people could start to reach those high mountain villages and little by little, Western society encroached upon that civilization. It's actually a very sad book to read because she chronicles what happens to the society of people who she said were the happiest people she had ever met in her whole life. She's done a lot of traveling as a linguist. But these people, you know, lived in what I call a subsistence culture. Had no educational needs whatsoever. It had no notion of this idea of work. They, by modern standards, of course, we would call them poor. Dismally poor, perhaps. But nonetheless, they were happy. They had no idea they were poor because they had nothing else to compare themselves to. But they had enough to eat. They had decent shelter. They had music and entertainment and a thriving local culture. But then, you know, all these other influences started to arrive on consumer goods, television especially. And they learned, the young people learned that they were poor, that they were deprived. They had no notion of this before. And little by little, Helena Norberg Hodge saw that people were becoming dissatisfied and angry and violent even with each other. And this notion of competition and scarcity slowly started to make its way into this society. And it's amazing how fast this stable culture fell apart once these influences entered their lives, their society. And I think that's something we need to think about and relearn, how to be satisfied within very narrow limits, to live well with consuming as little as possible, to develop what Illich and other people have called the virtue of enoughness, knowing when is enough and when is more than enough, when is too much. There's one thing that marks, I think, many of Ivan Illich's books is this notion that there are limits not only to the physical world, the ecological world, but to the social world, and to the way we live our lives. He defines culture in a way not many other people do, but he defines culture as those arrangements that society put into place to limit exchange relationships, commodity relationships, modern economic market relationships. They say, okay, we can have some of that, but very little, and we'll put it at the margins of society. We will not let that take over the way we live our lives, the way we relate to each other. The Amish are an example of a society that still exists in various parts of North America, where they place limits. And that, if you want to ask a question, where does an intact culture live today in North America, there's one. They place limits on their use of technology. You know, they ride around in horses and buggies for the most part and dress in very plain handmade clothing, etc., and grow their own food for the most part. And they have a vibrant, alive culture. It may not be a culture that we find attractive. It's religiously based, of course, but there is a culture for you. We don't have a culture today in America. We have patterns of consumerism. We have a homogenized culture where every place looks pretty much like every place else. Any city in the United States looks pretty much like any other place. It has the same stores, the same malls, the same commodities, and our freedom, which we like to parade around about and put in our anthems and stuff, has been reduced pretty much merely to the freedom of choice between different commodities. Otherwise, I think we're very much hemmed in by the institutions of our society. So I think we need to ask ourselves some very deep and fundamental questions, which is, what type of activities or type of tasks really are necessary in our society? Which tasks are superfluous? Today, people are afraid of not having enough money. That's the big risk in a consumer society, not being able to consume. If life entails consumption, if we don't have the commodity we need to consume with, which is money, the entity we need to consume with, the currency, then we're really in a bad way. Education is a precursor for that. Knowledge, which is what education is supposed to be about, is akin to capital. That's the entity that we're consuming in an educational arrangement. We are said to consume knowledge, and the more we have, the better. That prepares us for other types of consumption and other types of coercion, other types of manipulation. Mm. Today, of course, education is no longer unique to schooling, but it happens in many different areas, many parts of our society, through the media, through advertising, through all over the place. The games we play, the consumer goods that we buy are said to, you know, toys that the parents buy today always have this description of how it's going to be good for your children and this, that, and the other way. Everything is educational these days. This notion of growing without education is, for the most part, at this point in time, a thought experiment that I can't point to any place where, yes, people are living that way. The other thing that I think sometimes people get confused about is they think, am I saying that there's no role for teaching at all in such a society? Does that growing without education entail nobody shows anything to anybody anymore, nobody explains anything? No, that's not what I'm saying. Yeah, if somebody asks you a question, you answer it, if you know the answer. I'm not saying that you can't influence people, but you have to pay attention to the way your interactions are received by the person who is asking the question or subject to your influence. Teaching is fine as long as it's asked for, as long as it's welcomed by the person who is being taught. If it's not welcomed, if it's for your own good type of teaching, then yes, I'm against it. But it is a great joy and privilege to help someone do something that they want to do, that they ask you to help them with. And it's where that help or that teaching is not wanted, then the ambiguities and unequal aspects of power relationships come into play. That's where this idea of access comes in. We don't leave them in a vacuum, but we put within their reach those activities, those ways of life that we believe in ourselves. And then, you know, wait for them to take advantage of those opportunities, as mostly they will.
The end!
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.